to kick this thing off. Can I kick it off? One, two, three, boom.
What's going on, everybody? It's Mr. Lutz back again with yet another episode of World History with Class with Mr. Lutz. So I'm getting into the full swing of the school year and just starting to wear the energy a little bit thin, but hopefully I've got enough left in me in the tank here at 8:20 at night to get into a podcast for you on the spread and growth of Islam. So let's get right into the key concept connections here and keep things moving along today. So with today's episode, I don't know, maybe you might notice the difference in this, but I'm looking to go a little bit different for you. I'm going to try my best to kind of address different key concepts one at a time, as opposed to just listing them at the beginning and then just kind of plowing through different things. So we'll see if this makes any kind of a difference. So the first one I want to get into, I'm going to go a little bit out of order, key concept 3.2. And instead of giving you the full like gist of the entire key concept, I want to hone in on two specific aspects of key concept 3.2. The first one's going to be 3.2 point Roman numeral 1, and it's simply just that empires collapsed and were reconstituted, and in some regions, new state forms emerged. The other one, 3.2 point Roman numeral 2, interregional contacts and conflicts between states and empires encouraged significant technological and cultural transfers. So, where we kind of left off in the last episode about Islam is we were talking about the Abbasid Caliphate. And where we pick up in this episode today is going to be with Harun al-Rashid, who is going to be the fifth caliph of the Abbasids, who really brings in their high point in terms of wealth and splendor. This is going to be the Abbasid Caliphate of the Arabian Nights or the 1001 Nights. So this is kind of the one that gets romanticized and often told about. But what I want to focus on with Harun al-Rashid is not the glitz and the glamour, but rather the changes that are starting to occur within the Abbasid Empire. In the empire, you start to see at this point in time, the provinces are starting to exercise a little bit more independence than they had before. If you recall from the last episode, we talked about a lot of Persian bureaucratic influence coming into the Abbasid Caliphate, allowed them to really manage local affairs a lot better than perhaps the Umayyads had, but that's changing here. Court advisors are growing in influence. There's power struggles among the leadership. And then those power struggles magnify after the death of Harun al-Rashid. What you're going to see happen is there's going to be a power struggle with his sons after his death. And this is going to be something we are going to see frequently in the Islamic empires, this question of who leads next, because oftentimes there's not a definitive answer to the question. Take it back to Muhammad. That's where you get your original split between the Sunnis, who rally behind Abu Bakr because they see him as being the one who was kind of closest to Muhammad, the most aware of what Muhammad wanted to do with the faith. And then you have our friends, the sons of Ali, the Shia, who believe it should be a direct descendant of Muhammad. So these struggles over succession are going to plague not only the origins of the Islamic faith, but the empires that will follow for centuries to come here. So as this power struggle is really unfolding, the provincial governors really start to exercise even more independent authority, and they break themselves from Baghdad, and they're going to start to build up their own base of power. Later caliphs are going to attempt to move the capital from Baghdad to disrupt these power struggles to kind of offset them a bit, but this is a costly process, and all it's going to result in is more taxes being levied on the lowest classes of people who can afford those taxes the least, and that's going to lead to increased revolts among the peasants. So this weakness is going to lead to a group called the Buyids, who take control of Baghdad in 945. They're going to be replaced by another group called the Seljuks, or the Seljuk Turks, in 1055. We'll come back to them in a later episode. But the Abbasids are going to kind of remain, let's say. It's going to be more in a ceremonial role, and they'll be around till 1258, which is a major year in our study of world history. 1258 is going to be the year that the Mongols sack Baghdad. And this is going to happen under the leadership of Genghis Khan's grandson, who is known as Hulagu Khan. and he's going to, according to his own record at least, kill more than 200,000 citizens in Baghdad, and figuratively in some ways, but literally in other ways, send Baghdad into its dark ages. So a major turning point with that development. But again, just to harken back to 3.2 point Roman numeral 1, there you see the collapse of an empire being reconstituted into something else. You've got some nice specifics there. So moving along, we're going to talk about the spread of Islam for the remainder of 3.2 here, to South Asia in particular. And the year we're going to look to for that is going to be 711. Not the convenience store, the year. Keep that in mind. But maybe you might remember it that way. That's not a bad thing. So in 711, there's an army led by an Umayyad general named Muhammad ibn Qasim, who conquers an area known as Sindh. Sindh is basically in the southern Indus River Valley, kind of nearest the Arabian Sea. They're going to take control of this area, and the people living in the region of Sindh don't really mind this new leadership all that much. There's lower taxes, there's greater religious toleration, local institutions are maintained, they maintain a respect for the caste system. And for a while there, that's really all that comes about as far as Islam's contacts in South Asia. But later on, you're going to have a guy named Mahmud of Ghazni, who comes from a Turkish group in modern-day Afghanistan, raid into India and annex states located in the Punjab region, which is still pretty much Indus River Valley, but it's located to the north of Sindh. And Mahmud of Ghazni is going to be known for looting, destroying Hindu and Buddhist temples, and ultimately helping accelerate the decline of Buddhism, which is going to kind of come back to them later on here, as Hinduism and Islam are really going to clash and butt heads eventually, but not in the immediacy. So yeah, that takes us then to 3.2.2, again, interregional contacts and conflicts encourage significant, maybe not technological here, but certainly cultural transfers. So keeping things moving right along into 3.1 here, and I want to focus on 3.1 point Roman numeral 1, and that one says, improved transportation technologies and commercial practices led to an increased volume of trade and expanded the geographical range of existing and newly active trade networks. And then 3.1.2, the movement of peoples caused environmental and linguistic effects. Finally, 3.1 point Roman numeral 3, cross-cultural changes were fostered by the intensification of existing or the creation of new networks of trade and communication. So with this key concept, we're going to focus on the exchanges that come about as a result of Islam. And there's a couple of different topical things I want to focus on. First of all, in terms of science, this is the Islamic golden age. We are smack dab in the middle of it. It is going to be those living in the Abbasid Empire who are going to be the ones responsible for carrying on the legacy of the Greeks, of the Greek philosophers and scientists. A famous one who you'll have read about is a man named Ibn Rushd, who is going to make it his kind of life's mission to try and rectify the teachings and the philosophy and the scientific understandings of Aristotle and merge that with the beliefs of Islam, which becomes a huge thing because it's really going to influence this movement in Western Europe known as Scholasticism, which is basically the same thing. You're merging Aristotle, but instead of with the beliefs of Islam, it's with the beliefs of Christianity. But Ibn Rushd's efforts are definitely going to be rejected by some in the Islamic world, conservatives who think that the questions offered by religion cannot be tackled by a philosopher such as Aristotle. One in particular named Al-Ghazali is just going to completely reject the efforts that are made by guys like Ibn Rushd to do this. But also too, aside from like the philosophical connections between Islam and the Greek past, you're going to have the science and the math of the Greeks, and even the Indians are going to prove super influential in the Islamic world. Case in point, Hindi, or what we call Arabic numerals, are going to help Muslim mathematicians develop, yep, you can thank them for this, algebra and trigonometry and geometry. So when you're mumbling under your breath, you can shake your fist at those Muslims of the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries. But yeah, those Arabic numerals, the numerals that you use in math class, are going to come from these exchanges at this point in time. and developments in Indian medicine at this point are going to start to make their way into the Islamic empires. There's going to be physicians pulled out of India and taken into Baghdad and basically be assigned to work there, to be stationed there. So you really see the Muslims taking to this scientific and intellectual flourishing around the world and really trying to make themselves be at the center point of it all. So as we start to go into the 11th and 12th centuries, the biggest development coming around in Afro-Eurasia at that point, in my opinion, as a general pattern, is going to be the Crusades. And you know what, folks? I'm going to be honest with you here. I always get asked by people, you know, what should we know about the Crusades? What's the big deal? What's all the stuff to take away from it? And we'll tackle why they happened. And yeah, for those of you who love your video games and your Assassin's Creed, they're super interesting. But as far as what you need to understand about the Crusades, in my opinion, is going to be what were the long-term effects of the Crusades. And the biggest long-term effects that come out of the Crusades are what did the Crusades mean for Europe in terms of what they got with exchanges. The Muslims are not going to be as affected by European contacts. Remember, in period three, I haven't mentioned this yet, but it definitely bears mentioning right now, Western Europe is a backwater. Western Europe is an afterthought as far as when we talk about cultural and intellectual and social and even economic developments at this time. This is just not what anyone is thinking about whatsoever. So it's not like when the Europeans come that the Muslims of the Arabian Peninsula and of Africa and the Middle East are going to be like, Europe, please tell us, what are you guys doing right now? Because I'm sure it's awesome. It's absolutely the other way around. So what are Europeans going to take from the Crusades in the long term? You're going to get out of this a development of a renewed interest in Greek philosophy, a desire to want to wrap their heads around the developments in Islamic science, in their mathematic developments, in their medicine. This is where paper production is going to start to emerge at this point. The Europeans are going to take to some new foods that will start to work their way into the European culture slowly but surely. Spices, sugar, coffee, dates, these things start to make their way into European lifestyles. The game of chess is going to come in here. New ideas about tactics and weaponry that are being used. An interest in cotton and a renewed interest in silk and Persian rugs. All this stuff is going to come as a result of the Crusades. Because the Europeans are kind of venturing beyond what's been comfortable for them for so long. And this is really what's going to kickstart, eventually, the Renaissance that will emerge there. So, keeping things moving on here, as far as the exchanges that occur in this period, we've also got religious conversion in India. You know, we mentioned a little bit about the Muslims interacting in India, but as far as religious conversion, it's going to come primarily at the hands of the Sufis. Sufi mystics are going to do a huge service in helping to spread the influence of Islam to both South Asia and Southeast Asia. And there's a couple reasons for that. They're not concerning themselves with religious doctrine. In other words, they're not obsessing over the minute details of what the texts say. But what they're trying to do is live a life where they demonstrate a devotion to Allah above all else. And that is way more attainable for the common person, especially at this time period, who aren't necessarily literate, who can't memorize complicated texts. They can, though, demonstrate a devotion to a god. That's much more attainable for them. They're going to be way more tolerant of syncretizing Islam. It's going to be a word you're going to hear a lot, and I think we'll talk more about this concept of syncretism as these episodes go on. But basically, for this point in time, what you should understand about syncretism is this idea that native religious traditions or practices are going to kind of blend and be accepted as valid practices within Islam. There are certainly going to be Muslims who would reject that and say this is a violation of the values that we hold dear to us, but the Sufis do not count themselves among that. So it's kind of like saying, like, hey, you keep doing what you're doing. Don't change your religious practices. That's the key word there. but you can start to incorporate your beliefs in this God, Allah. And that becomes a much more easy transition for a lot of people. The Sufis show a great devotion to their religion. They show a great respect to the people who they interact with. They're tolerant. They're kind to these people. They're going to welcome low-caste individuals to the faith. They're going to establish certain functions like militias to help protect the regions in which they're operating. And it's just like they're just getting their hands dirty. They're willing to do the tough stuff. They're willing to get in with the people and mix it up. And for that, it's going to gain them a lot of support. And there's going to be people who are willing to convert as a result. And originally, the Hindu upper classes, they're not too concerned about these developments. I hope if you think back to what we learned about Hinduism, is this idea that Hinduism sees itself as being a religion that can absorb and adopt practices and beliefs of other faiths and can kind of take these things in. But what they really don't understand yet is that Islam is going to be a lot more rigid and inflexible than these other faiths that they've tried to do this with before. You know, going back to the five pillars, the declaration of faith, saying that there is no God but God and Muhammad is his messenger, it's going to make it really complicated to connect that and try to merge that with Hinduism. It's just not going to happen. Nonetheless, folks, people are going to try to give it the old college try. There's going to be a group called the Bhakti Movement, and they are going to try to erase the distinctions between these two faiths. And maybe for a short period of time it does work, but eventually the Brahmin class are going to take a stand against Islam. They're frustrated about the temple destruction. They're angered over the inflexibility of the faith. They're concerned with the fact that this faith is spreading to the lower castes. This faith that preaches, relatively speaking, a much stronger sense of egalitarianism than Hinduism does at this time. And so they're concerned about losing the support of the lower castes. And we'll see that pop back up again here. As far as Islam spreading to Southeast Asia, you see waves of voluntary conversion happening here. Merchants are going to be the ones who bring the first wave of exposure. They're insisting to the people they interact with, a little bit of a lie here, that most of the world that is known to them has converted. So then the people in Southeast Asia are like, oh my goodness, has that really happened? I probably should convert then. And they're going to make sure this happens above all else in the port cities of Southeast Asia. Because what this can do, aside from just give someone a higher purpose in life, in a much more logical sense, it helps build ties between trading communities. There's a set of common beliefs that people can agree upon, a common sense of decency, even common legal practices. And it just really allows for these merchant networks to understand each other a lot more easily. But in Southeast Asia, there are still some places that are holdouts. Mainland Southeast Asia is going to remain a stronghold for Buddhism. The island of Bali in Indonesia, at least at this point, is going to stay largely Hindu. And so, you do see a lot of cultural adoption and intellectual adoption happening at this time, but it's not everywhere and everything all at once. And we got to keep that in mind. Okay, so we're going to move on to 3.3 now. So with key concept 3.3, I think there's really only one that I'd like to focus on in particular, and that's 3.3. Roman numeral 3. And that states, despite significant continuities in social structures and methods of production, there were also some important changes in labor management and the effect of religious conversion on gender relations and family life. So I want to focus here briefly on the declining role of women at this time. Where we left off in the last episode, Islam had been a relatively egalitarian faith when you compare it with its neighbors. But in the time of the Abbasids, it starts to change. And what you start to see in this time period is the adoption of cultural values from their old neighbors, the Byzantines and the Sassanids. These are, remember, sedentary, patriarchal societies. Islam does not start that way. Islam, if you recall, grows out of the Bedouins. It grows out of nomadic pastoralists who maybe don't have as much patriarchy in their life. But now these sedentary societies who they're interacting with do. So you're going to see the emergence of the court harem, which is going to keep women of the court secluded from the public. And the only way that they're going to become freed is if they're given birth to healthy sons. You know, big one here, the veil, what a lot of us are going to associate with Islam, becomes a feature of daily life for most classes of women other than slaves. But again, you've got to understand, this is not something that is native to Islam. It was native to the Byzantines and the Sassanids. But even women within the Abbasid Empire, you know, it's complicated. Upper class women, they don't have an avenue for upward mobility. They're stuck in their limited gender role. But women in the lower classes, within the framework of their daily life, they do exercise more authority or more autonomy, excuse me, and more independence. And the last thing here, kind of a complicated thing to explain, but in India, women are going to experience marriage at an early age. Some upper caste Muslims in India are going to continue this practice known as sati, which translates, maybe not directly, forgive me, but basically what's known as bride burning. There's no good way to explain this. If a husband dies and his wife is widowed, in some upper class circles in India, it was expected of the female to throw herself on her husband's funeral pyre, that is, his burning remains, and to self-immolate herself, to set herself on fire, to be burned to death with her husband. And if this wasn't done, you could be ostracized and shamed from your community, and some upper caste Muslims will adopt this practice. Something, unfortunately, we're going to revisit throughout history in parts in India. Yeah, there's no good way to transition out of that one. Sorry. Okay. So, moving on. I wanted to go into our zooming in feature here and get into an article that I just recently read on my newfound subscription, the fourth love of my life after my daughter, my wife, and my dog, a website called historytoday.com. And it's an amazing website. Unfortunately, a lot of it is pay, but basically it's a popular magazine about history, but the article's written by some pretty notable scholars of history. And the one article they pulled out for this episode is one about the Byzantines and the Abbasids. And it's this idea that they were the worst of enemies. I would not go in to say the best of friends, but the article definitely suggests that in spite of this massive rivalry that they have with one another, they've got a trade relationship and a love of ancient Greece that bonds them together. And it's just this suggestion, it's such a mantra of mine, history is always more complicated than we want it to be. The history of the Byzantines and the Abbasids is not just characterized by war. There's more to it. And the article is great. It begins by talking about Osama bin Laden. For those of you who don't know much about him, because strange enough as it may seem to me, you guys, some of you weren't even born when 9/11 happened. Oh my goodness, that's crazy. Anyway, so Osama bin Laden, loved to suggest that there has just been this never-ending struggle between the Christian world and the Islamic world that could never be rectified. And even with today, the Islamic State, the so-called Islamic State, makes it seem as if the history between Christianity is just one of mutual antagonism and hatred and nothing else. And that is so misleading. And man, like, I just want to make it my mission as a teacher to just disrupt this notion whenever I can. Of course, there is a history of struggle between the two. The Abbasids and the Umayyads, even before them, had taken land at the expense of the Byzantines. There's constant struggles going on in their borderlands as well. They believe that they're taking the righteous action against the enemy who they perceive as being the infidels. My favorite part of this article, though, I'm going to read you some quotes here. There's intellectual debates between the two religions. They look at the beliefs and the values and the practices of one another as being inferior, but in some instances, there's a complete misunderstanding of what the other group believes. The article gives an example of a Byzantine emperor, Constantine VII, who actually thought that Muslims worshipped Venus, as in the planet. And here's the quote that he has, and you can kind of see like where that weird misunderstanding comes from. He says, "And they pray, moreover, to the star of Aphrodite, which they call Kubar. In their supplication, they cry out, 'Allah wa Kubar,' this is God and Aphrodite. For they call God Allah, and wa they use for the conjunction end, and they call the star Kubar. And so they say, 'Allah wa Kubar.'" So obviously that's a complete misunderstanding of Allahu Akbar, which is just saying that God is great, and he thinks they say God and Aphrodite. So he's just like, oh, of course, they worship Venus. Bunch of weirdos. Like, no, totally wrong. And then even there's examples of Muslims who thought that Christians didn't worship one God, but actually worship three gods because of the Holy Trinity. So there's just a misunderstanding there. It's like, guys, you worship the same God. Probably should know that. Anyway, the connections is the cool part that I liked about this. The article goes on to talk about, sure, there's prisoner exchanges. Sometimes they're meeting them across either side of a bridge and meeting in the middle, and they take their exchange prisoner one way and the enemy's exchange prisoner the other way. But with trade, they see it as a necessity. Both groups believe, you know, we need this because we can tax it and we need revenue. Who doesn't? One of my favorite examples from this article was a Byzantine diplomat, a guy with a name any English teacher would envy, John the Grammarian, who took in the wonders of Baghdad in his diplomatic travels and just was wowed and awed at the splendor and the wealth that this empire had in its hands. And on his travels back, he ended up convincing his emperor that he should build a country home in the same exact design as that of the caliph of the Abbasid's palace that he had seen. And I just think stuff like that is just so cool. There's also, you know, don't forget, we talked about the Abbasids loving the Greeks, but so do the Byzantines. The Byzantines inherit the geography and the language of the Greeks. They're seen as the intellectual heartland of the Greeks. They have a passion for their literature. And then the Arabs, they developed the interest in the Greeks because they had taken the former eastern provinces of the Hellenic world of Alexander the Great. They've got Alexandria. Alexandria is loaded with books from the Greek past. So as we've talked about before, they take the interest in the philosophy and the science and the math. And they admire the Muslim intellectuals because they see them as the keepers of the Greek works. And the Byzantines will sometimes kind of keep themselves in a good light with the Muslims by giving ancient Greek texts to Muslim caliphs as gifts, even. Here's another quote from the article for you. It says, quote, "There were those who believed that both Byzantium and the Abbasid Caliphate, although divided by religion, were distinguished through their knowledge and wisdom from other peoples. Striking in this respect is a letter written by Nicholas Mystikos, the Patriarch of Constantinople, in about the 10th century, probably to an Abbasid caliph. In it, the patriarch described their two societies as their lordships, which stand above all lordship upon earth. They had both received this authority from God and were therefore brothers superior to and preferred above their brethren. For this very reason, the patriarch urged Byzantines and Arabs ought to be brotherly and in contact with each other." Kind of interesting. Suggesting, you know, we have things that are unique to us. We have received our authority to rule from God. We are above everyone else and superior to everyone else. But to contextualize, the article goes on to mention, quote, "The letter is unusual and by no means typical of approaches made by Byzantine clergymen to Muslim potentates. Its context needs to be considered as well. Nicholas was writing in the hope that the caliph would release some Christian prisoners, so it's hardly surprising that he was flattering," end quote. It's just kind of interesting there. You know, context is everything, right? As I've taught you, I'm sure, a million times by this point in the year, I'm going to assume. We'll be right back. All right, I don't really have much to add, honestly. So for the sake of wrapping this up pretty quickly, for my particular students, just my recommendation in the explainer is going to be in the back of your unit booklets, you've got vocab there. Start looking over that. Start figuring out how you can use those specific vocab terms to substantiate arguments that you're making in class, because hitting on those terms is definitely going to help you clarify with specific facts when you feel like you stall and you can't explain yourself in any kind of specifics. I don't really have any more recommendations to make for you. Doubling down on Heads on History. It is so stinking good. I'll link it again. Go listen to it. That's it. You guys go enjoy yourselves. I'm going to go sleep. I'm beat. It's, 9 o'clock? I'm going to go settle into some kind of nighttime snack or something. I don't know. You go do the same. You earned it. I'm absolutely sure of it. Take care, everyone.